only verse 1. And Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribe of Manasseh. Said unto them, you kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and obeyed my voice, and all that I commanded you. You have not left your brethren these many days unto this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren, as he has promised them. Therefore now return ye, and get you unto your tents, and unto the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side Jordan. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you, to love the Lord your God, and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments, and to cleave unto him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went unto their own tents. Now let's go down to verse 9. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and half tribe of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel out of Shiloh to the land of Canaan to go into the country of Gilead to the land of their possession, whereof they possessed according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. When they were come to the borders of Jordan in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by Jordan, a great altar to see to. And the children of Israel heard say, behold, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh have built an altar over against the land of Canaan in the borders of Jordan at the passage of the children of Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go up to war against them. And the children of Israel sent unto the children of Reuben, unto the children of Gad, and the other half of Manasseh, into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, with him 10 princes, of each chief house, a prince throughout all the tribes of Israel, each one with the head of the house of their father, and of the thousand of Israel. They came unto the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead. They spake with them, saying, thus saith the whole congregation of the Lord, what trespass is this that you have committed against the God of Israel, to turn away this day from following the Lord, and that you have builded you an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor, that's Baal Peor, too little for us, from which we are not cleansed until this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord? But that you must turn away this day from following the Lord, and it will be, seeing you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be wroth with the whole congregation of Israel? Notwithstanding, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass ye over into the land of the possession of the Lord, wherein the Lord's tabernacle dwelleth, and take possession in among us. But rebel not against the Lord, nor rebel against us, in building you an altar beside the altar of the Lord our God. You know, Achan, the son of Zerah, committed trespass and the accursed thing, and wrought for all the congregation of Israel? And that man perished not alone in his iniquity. Then the children of Reuben, because up until now they've been listening to a whole bunch of accusations. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh answered and said unto the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth, and Israel he shall know. If it be in rebellion, or if it be in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day, that we have built us an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer thereon burnt offering or meat offering, or to offer up peace offerings thereon, let the Lord himself require it. And if we have not rather done it for fear of this thing, saying, in time to come your children may speak unto our children, saying, what have ye to do with the Lord God of Israel? For the Lord hath made Jordan the border between us and you, ye children of Reuben, children of Gad. You have no part in the Lord. So shall your children make our children cease from fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between us and you and our generation after us, that we might do the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in time to come, ye have no part in the Lord. Therefore said we, that it shall be, when they should so say to us, or to our generations in time to come, that we may say again, behold, the pattern of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between us and you. God forbid that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following the Lord to build an altar for burnt offerings, for meat offerings, or for sacrifices, beside the altar of the Lord our God, that is his tabernacle. And when Phinehas the priest and the princes of the congregation, heads of the thousands of Israel which were with him, heard the words of the children of Reuben and the children of Gad, children of Manasseh, spake, it pleased them. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, said unto the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and to the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among us, because you have not committed this trespass against the Lord. Now ye have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and the princes returned from the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, at the land of Gilead, and the land of Canaan, to the children of Israel, brought them word again. And the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed God, and did not intend to go up against them in battle to destroy the land wherein the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar Ed, for it should be a witness between us that the Lord is God. And so the chapter deals with some misunderstanding between brethren here. We need to look at that to see if we can get some principles far from it. So, up until now then, we've had these 2.5 tribes who have been leading the armies of Israel in the conquest of the land. And now it's come time for them to return because the land is conquered. And when Joshua sent them back, we need to notice that he sent them back with the highest possible commendation. And he says that in verse 2 onwards. You've kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you. Obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you. And so on. So he gives them his commendation here before they return to their homes and families. Highest possible praise for their obedience here to his own commands, to their faithfulness to God, and to their brethren. You know, interesting to notice, isn't it, that the Holy Spirit delights to record incidents of the obedience of the saints. He does it earlier in this book at the commencement of this venture of theirs when these soldiers of these 2.5 tribes started out in chapter 4, and he records it, that they went into battle at the front of the armies. And now at the end of the time leading the armies of Israel, again he records the faithfulness of these brethren in what they had done. Notice too something else here, verse 4. And now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren. He is careful, is Joshua, to give the praise for the victory to God. It is God who has given rest to them. So he recognizes and gives the praise of the victory to God. Now, in the passage which follows, he gives no instruction for the safety of their cities. What he does do is he gives some rules for the regulating of their lives, and they are found in verse 5. So he says in verse 5, but take diligent heed to the commandment of the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you. And this is what it is. To love the Lord. And that's the basic demand by God of all his people. Whenever age. To love the Lord. Secondly, he says, and to walk in all his ways. The boundary of their movement through life, yes, it's the boundary of our movement through life, is to be the will of God. Every step of acknowledgement of God. And really, it's only as we walk in his ways and are obedient to him that we can enjoy fellowship with him. And so the second command was to walk in the ways of God. Then thirdly, they were to hold fast to God. There's no doubt that God will hold fast to Israel. Even when they were disobedient, and even now, their future is assured in his purposes for them. But there was no doubt that at this time he would hold fast to Israel, and not one of his good promises to Israel would fail, and in the future will not fail. But they are to hold fast to God, and sadly, that's something they failed to do. Because when you come into the period of the kings, you find that both Judah and Israel, the 10 tribes, went astray and worshipped other gods. And then last of all, they were to obey his commands, and we're looking again at this one, I've gone the wrong order, I think it doesn't matter. They were to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways, to keep his commandments. That's a true expression of a love to God, is obedience to God. If you love me, keep my commandments, and they were to serve God. I left one out, but I'll come back to that now. To serve God with all your hearts. They've been chosen by God to be the vehicle of blessing to this world, and they were to serve him. And then lastly, and I go back to that one, and they were to cleave to him. So then, for the so much for the commendation that they have, and the pathway of duty which is before them. Now they are to take with them, and a little bit further down you'll notice in verses 7 and 8, they were to take with them the spoils that they had. Return with much riches unto your tents, verse 8. Very much cattle, with silver, with gold, with brass, with iron, very much raiment, and so on. And so the spoil which they had, they took back with them to share with those who had been left behind to guard their possessions. And that particular principle you'll find later in the 30th chapter of 1 Samuel. Because those who had remained behind to look after their possessions in the 2.5 territories across Jordan, their work had been as necessary as those who had gone to fight. Those who had stayed by the staff, their work was as necessary as those who had led the battle. And of course we need to remember that we mustn't despise our brethren or begrudge them the rewards of service. If God has placed him somewhere and he's done that service for God, even if it means working in a lowly position for God, and some of us perhaps think we are occupied in the front of the fight, we must not despise the brother who's doing the work for God where God has placed him. Now, instead of rushing home, what they did was they built an altar. Now, in a sense, they could have rushed home. They'd been a long time away from home. But in a sense, what they were doing was they were putting God first in building this altar, even before they had seen their loved ones and their possessions. And what they were saying is, well, nothing's going to come between us and God, not even the need we have to see our homes and our loved ones and our vineyards and all the rest of it. We want to build this altar first. We're not going to give the worship of God second place. We're going to build this altar. Though, of course, you will remember that this altar was not actually for sacrifice, but it was an indication that they belonged to the God of Israel, and they wanted to remember that. And so, longings for home and longings for family and all the rest, in this case, took second place in relation to their desire for God. And you know, the expression of the psalmist is, in his longings for God, that his desires for God were so great that they were compared to the hart who panted after the water brooks. And here was a desire for God being expressed, and they didn't give him second place and rushed home, but first of all, they were going to build this memorial to him. And so they were going out across Jordan, but they weren't going to give up Israel's God. And so they showed their determination to keep their interests in the land and to indicate their part in the God of Israel. Now, you know, sometimes it's, our children are called upon to leave home, to work or to study. And we've had that experience as parents ourselves. And sometimes they're called upon to work or study where God isn't honored. And it's a useful lesson, this altar. Because in this altar, what the children of Reuben and so on were really saying is, this is our God forever and ever. And we want to put this altar to indicate that to ourselves and to our children. And it's a useful lesson to young people who go away to study or work, to remember, to, or should I say, to express this determination, which I've just uttered. This is our God forever and ever. Never to forget that though they may be in a different place, this is their God. Now the reason it was sound, really, because what they wanted, and they explained it later on, was that their children would be recognized as a part of Israel, and they want their children to recognize themselves as a part of Israel. So the idea of the altar was to cement the relationship between these tribes over one side of the Jordan and the majority tribes over the other side. Of course, in a sense, that purpose could have been served later if they obeyed the divine command and had come up to Jerusalem and assembled themselves together at the feasts and the offerings. And in a sense, you can't secure unity by external symbols. Some people try to do that. But you can secure unity more by spiritual fellowship. However, they built it, and there it was. Also, they were going to call Eb. Now, God would have us abstain from every form of evil. And when we formulate plans, and when we carry out intentions of the heart, sometimes those plans and intentions may cause and result in misunderstanding between brethren, as it did in this particular case. You see, a memorial had been built when they crossed Jordan. When that memorial was built when they crossed Jordan, there was no misunderstanding. And the reason why there was no misunderstanding was that God had commanded them to build it. So here it was, as a witness to their posterity, this witness of a miraculous crossing of the Jordan into the land. And that was there to remind their children, who to ask, what do you mean by these stones, and give them the ability and the opportunity to explain to them concerning God's miraculous dealings for them. So that particular altar, or that particular cairn of an altar which had been built by the Jordan in the first instance when they came into the land, was what they were commanded to do. But this one, they had not been commanded to build. This was something they built through human reasoning and planning. This was of their own devising. And, we've got to be careful, of course, of any addition to the will of God or to the divine pattern, or any departure from the divine pattern, or any subtraction from the divine pattern, because it could land us in difficulty. But having said that, the motives of these men were genuine enough. I mean, it was there to be a witness to their children, that they belonged to Israel, they were part of Israel, they were not separate off from Israel, though they were the other side of Jordan. So the motive was what was fair enough. The only problem is that very often when we plan things and with all the good intention of our hearts, there is sometimes, particularly if we haven't consulted about it, or we haven't any definite guidance in it, there is the possibility to be misunderstood. And it happened here. They built this cairn, and the other tribes thought they were setting out to be independent, setting out themselves up against the Lord, building a separate altar from what was there at Shiloh, and so they prepared for war. Now, only 5 minutes before, Joshua had given these brethren a commendation, and he had spoken highly of what they had done. And within this very short time, after this cairn was built, the very people who owed a debt to them, because they helped to conquer the land for them, were now getting ready to go to war with them, and were ready to destroy the brethren who had fought for them all these years in order to get the land conquered. And the problem is, when you look at this passage, is that these good brethren who were going to war, they did not ask for any explanation. They never asked why the other brethren built this thing. They asked for no explanation at all. You know, in a moment of misunderstanding, we as brethren, fellowship with one another, in the seminaries, you know, in a moment of misunderstanding, we can also sometimes be ready to fight against someone who has been a great blessing to us and with whom we shared happy fellowship in the past. And then something has come as a misunderstanding between us. And you know, misunderstandings can be a very damaging thing. And the trouble is that however sincere we may be, we're all apt to misunderstand one another's motives and to judge one another wrongly, because we don't know what's going on in another's heart. And so the Lord Jesus said, you know, he said, judge not that ye be not judged. That's Matthew 7, verse 1. Now, of course, there are circumstances in which you and I are called upon to judge, and the word judge in Matthew chapter 7 has in mind critical or destructive judgment. And then, of course, it's illustrated about the man who looks at the other fellow and he sees a speck of sawdust in his eye. And so he condemns him, judges him for the speck of sawdust in his eye. And what makes the problem even greater is that he now sets about setting this fellow right. But, says the Lord, and if you don't think that the Lord had any humour, I'm sure that it was in this particular case, because he said this man can't get it within an arm's breadth of him, because this guy's only got a bit of sawdust in his eye, but the other fellow's got a plank sticking out of his eye, and it's so long he can't get near him. And sometimes we can be like that, you know. We can try and get the sawdust unaware that there's a great big plank sticking in our own eye. We can't get near him. And sometimes we aren't prepared to understand or even ask about another's motives. Well, they all met at Shiloh. And that's where the tabernacle was. And you know, what they should have done when they were there is this, they should have consulted there. After all, Eliezer was there, wasn't he? Urim and Thummim were there. Shouldn't they have asked and consulted? But you see, they didn't, because the case seemed a shut and dried case. It was so plain that they thought advice was unnecessary. And I've always found that when there are difficult problems regarding brethren, I've always found that the first thing that we need to be aware of is our own sheer lack of wisdom, and then to ask God to supply us with the wisdom we will need. And their inconsiderateness brands their brethren with crimes which are innocent. They're going to be schismatic. They're going to set up a different altar. And you know, the problem is that they did it all on hearsay. Verse 11, and the children of Israel heard say. In other words, it was just hearsay, it was a rumor. You know, it's wrong to assume guilt on a mere report. And good men can be betrayed into hasty and wrong judgments. Israel heard say. Now, hearsay, often, frequently, freely, attributes motives, and sadly it seldom takes the trouble to understand the motives. So the eastern tribes had built an altar. An altar must be for sacrifice. So they intended to sacrifice. They were not going to sacrifice at Jerusalem then, so they were setting up a separate altar. But you see, the assumption was wrong. They weren't going to do that. An assumption leads speedily to false accusations. So what they did was they got a delegation together, led by Phinehas. And this delegation was sent to make inquiry before warfare broke out. So that was the first intelligence step they made. They weren't going to take certain action yet until there had been a proper investigation of the report heard. And they wanted face-to-face contact with the people who had committed this wrong, as they said, thought. And you know, that was a good step, really. Because motives and events have to be understood, really. Even if the action is not what we ourselves would do, we need to understand the motives why somebody else has done this particular thing. And Phinehas led the delegation. Now, Phinehas, of course, represented the tribe of Levi. He was the son of Eleazar. He had a name in the nation for zeal and enthusiasm. He had a name in the nation for his zeal for God and for truth. You remember that he was the man at Baal Poa who had killed the sinning couple on that particular occasion. And he had a zeal for dealing with apostasy, as was shown in that particular incident. Now, they were quite confident that with the Phinehas, the honor of Jehovah's name would be maintained. After all, you had done that at Baal Poa. And of course, the other side of the thing was this, that if Phinehas exonerated the rest, these other 2.5 tribes, then, you know, so zealous a person as Phinehas would certainly indicate blamelessness, and he'd restore confidence in the other 2 tribes. So his choice was pretty sound. And so the delegation go down. Now I want you to notice what happened. They go down to meet these tribes. And verse 15 tells us what happens. When they came, they spake with them, saying, "Thus saith the whole congregation of Israel, what trespass is this that you have committed against the God of Israel to send away this day from following the Lord, and that you have built an altar, that you may rebel this day against the Lord?" So do you notice what they did not do? They didn't ask one single question. They didn't say, "Why are you doing this?" They didn't say, "What's your motive? What's your thinking?" Nothing like that at all. When they come down, the first thing that happens is that they immediately start judging their brethren who'd helped them in the conquest of the land. What trespass? So they're already accusing them of doing that which is wrong. They've trespassed. And they've already judged them. Sad that. You see, they've become self-righteous promised land dwellers. So much so that they didn't even see the need to ask any questions at all. And in actual fact, they do it perhaps I have done in circumstances too. They sermonize. Well now, it was assumed that the altar was a violation of the altar which was up there at Shiloh.
As we're going through this, you still have to admire their zeal, for they thought another altar of sacrifice had been erected, whether you agree with all their methodology or not. Yes. But it's interesting to note the declension of the nation as a whole through history. Here they're willing to go to war, but again, as you brought out, they first investigate. Some 400 to 500 years later, under King Rehoboam, when Jeroboam erects two false altars with different sacrifices in different cities and different priesthoods, virtually no one in Israel protested other than the man of God. 400 or 500 years later, what's an issue here is not even an issue with the people of God. And the Church of God today, what were issues hundreds of years ago, virtually are not issues today. And it's something we must not lose the right kind of zeal.
Yes. Yes. And what I'm pointing out is a methodology rather than anything else. Yes. Yes. The zeal for God was there. It's the methodology I think they were completely wrong at. Zeal later on when the cows were put at Bethel and Dan. That's right. But what I'm trying to point out here is the methodology they adopted in this particular case. And the methodology they adopted was suspect and wrong because of the things that they did not do which they should have done. So they accused them of building this altar, which is a violation of the single sanctuary, of course, and disobeying the law of God. And they referred to two things. The sin of Baal Peor, that's verse 17, because that was one which stood out in the knowledge of the children of Israel as one of the grievous occasions when they went a-warring after other gods. And they were afraid that this was another occasion of that. And then, of course, the sin of Achan at the entry to the land when he committed a trespass and a cursed thing. So they highlight these two great sins which were in their memories. And they highlight them as a disastrous result of idolatry and unfaithfulness. Now, there was a concept, of course, of cooperative responsibility again here. Because you will notice what it says, he will be wroth, verse 18, he will be wroth with the whole congregation of Israel. It goes back to that collective responsibility which existed at the time of of Achan's sin. And they refer back to that. And so, if the eastern tribes are going to build rival altars, it will cause the whole congregation of Israel to reap the wrath of God. And verse 18 tells us he will be wroth with the whole congregation of Israel. And so they reasoned. Now, it's got to be said in their favor, as well as their zeal, as has been pointed out, it's got to be pointed out that they were also prepared to make sacrifices for this 2.5 tribes. Because what they say to them is that if what they will do is that they are prepared to bring them over into the land itself and to give them a possession in the land. And verse 19 tells them that. To give them a possession among us, but not to rebel against the law. If it was a case of building an altar at which they would worship rather than to Jerusalem, well, they were prepared to get them into the land and to give them possession in the land. Now, you know, that's quite a generous offer. Because what it meant was this, that the land would be redistributed, there was 2.5 tribes would be coming into it, and it would mean sacrifice on the part of other tribes, the reallocation of territory, and some inconvenience. So it was a generous offer on their part. So they're prepared to offer them inheritance on the other side of Jordan. They did that, rather than have them worship at another altar. So, it shows that the moving spirit in their remonstrance, their method might have been suspect, but the moving spirit in their remonstrance was to be found in a love for God and in a jealousy for his commandments. And that certainly comes out here. Now, let's just put ourselves for a moment on the side of the 2.5 tribes. How do they feel, I wonder? Well, the 2.5 tribes had been recently commended by Joshua. Now they've been accused. And how do they handle it? What would you think if you had served your brethren faithfully and you had done something with a good intention and now you're being accused of doing something which is wrong? How would you feel? How would you handle it? Well, I suppose they were deeply wounded, and their words indicate that. See, if your whole life has been a striving against sin, and their whole experience so far had been a striving against the Canaanites, you would feel acutely hurt if you were unjustly accused of something, having wronged your brethren, forfeited your good name, dishonored your God. And their wounded love comes out in their defense. And I want you to notice now their defense of themselves. And it goes on from verse 21 down. See, they were innocent of the charge against them. They weren't building an altar for sacrifice. They were trying to perpetuate interest in that very altar for which they have been accused of rebelling. They wanted to be part of Israel. And when you read what they say, there's no word of reproach, no temper, no recrimination in vindication of themselves. They simply say, well, you know, this is what we intended to do. And from verse 27, they just express the reason. It may be a witness between us and you, and our generation after us, that we might do the service before him with our burnt offerings, our sacrifice, our peace offerings, that your children may not take our children in time to come. You have no part in the Lord. And so they give their answer in verses 27 and 28. They appeal to God's knowledge very strongly. You will notice what they say in verse 29. God forbid that we should rebel against the Lord. And they appeal strongly to him. And to his knowledge, the strong God, they say, who will justify them. And there's no spirit of bitterness in what they say. There is a genuine spirit of reconciliation. Now, notice the response to that with the princes. Phinehas, the priest, and the princes heard the words, and they accepted what was said. Now they've been told the reason and the motives. And they recognized that they were genuine in what they had done. And that the God of peace was amongst them, and strife was averted, and war was unnecessary. And of course it all ends with a matter of praise to God. And that's basically the story of it. I wonder if there are lessons for us to learn. Let me try and draw some of the lessons which I see here. Let's look at the 11 the 2.5 tribes on the eastern side. First of all, the building of the altar of the cairn of stones when they came out of Jordan had divine approval. They were told to do it. This has no divine communication, command to do. So they haven't done it because of a divine communication, but a divine command. They are doing this on the basis of personal reasoning and thinking. Secondly, what they didn't do was they didn't communicate with the others. They didn't tell the others what they were doing and why they were doing it. Their communication was at fault. And you know, this was a matter of considerable importance. In fact, it was a sort of sacred matter. And no step really should have been taken without full consultation with the other tribes. So the other tribes knew what they were about. And as a result, what they had done as an effort to maintain unity almost ended in a fatal schism. But as far as their motive was concerned, the motive was honest enough. But one of the great faults that they had was, A, there was no divine command about it, and B, there was no communication with the others. Well, obviously, what we should do, we should always have a thus saith the Lord for. And secondly, perhaps one of the things which sometimes is lacking in our assembly is a lack of communication between brothers. Now let's look at the other side and look at the 10 tribes. Well, first of all, they were a bit over hasty, because they should have inquired first, which they didn't do. They started off on their way, and their very zeal for the truth perhaps took them further than they intended to go. Because when they got down to them, not having inquired, they started with an accusation. You know, there's but a step between zeal and human passion. And too often anger against others hides under a plea of love to God. I've heard a brother say, I say this in love. And sometimes I've wondered why it is I got such a beating. But you see, men who give way to holy wrath need to accompany that with holy prayer, with humble prayer. They didn't first seek the counsel of God for their action here. And when Phinehas came down, he spoke first and listened second. And I want to say, as from experience in a local assembly, as one of the elders of local assembly, that I found that so easy to do. To speak first and listen afterwards. I had all the answers. What we need to do is to listen first to what the problem is, and then prayerfully consider what to say. And of course, just as we require that they should be examined before being condemned, though of course they accused them of committing trespass. However, what did happen was that the 2.5 tribes showed patient forbearance, and the having shown that, their explanation was graciously accepted. I would imagine that if they had lost their tempers, then it might not have been so. But it was accepted in this particular case. Now, let's just look at what happens here then. First of all, there was rumor. And they took the rumor as being truth. They went down, and rumor was supplanted by reason. And reason led to understanding, and understanding averted war. God was in their midst. But I wonder how many times that situation has been reversed, and understanding hasn't resulted, and there's been a breakdown of relationships. Now, there is a right procedure, and let's turn to that right procedure now, shall we? The book of Deuteronomy, chapter 13. Verse 12. If thou shalt hear say in one of the cities which the Lord thy God hath given thee to dwell there, saying, certain men, the children of Belial, are gone out from among you, and they withdrawn the inhabitants of this city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known. Now you see the parallel with the thing which I've talked about. Now this is what they're to do. Then shalt thou inquire, and make search, and ask diligently, And behold, if it be truth, and the thing certain, that such abomination is among you. So notice what they were to do. It certainly required both action and patience, but they were to inquire. They were to seek the answer to the difficulty. They were to search. They were to intensely study the evidence for proof. And they were to ask diligently. They were to make direct interrogation. So they were to follow a process of justice which would lead them to a righteous decision. And you know, in the matter of misunderstanding between brethren, that sort of procedure is what's necessary to follow. Because we are tragically too easily led to misunderstand our brethren's motives. May God give us the grace to realize that we ourselves might sometimes be wrong, and to realize that in the averting of division between brethren, patience and humility and an attempt to understand, a love for the truth, and a love for God, and a love for one's brethren, all these things are necessary constituents in the matter. May God give us grace in that way. Randy, please.